Good morning, everybody. If people could come in and take their seats, please, we're going to get going. My name is Vicki Rideout, and I'm the director of the Kaiser Foundation's Program for the Study of Media and Health. And thank you all for joining us here this morning for this event. I want to start by just talking a little bit about why it is we think this topic of kids and media is so important. And simply put, there is nothing that occupies more of young people's time than media. Not school, not church, not family. According to the study that we're releasing here today, children between the ages of 8 and 18 years old in this country spend an average of more than 53 hours a week with media. I mean, this is more time than most adults spend in a full-time job. Anything that occupies this much of kids' lives, I think, is something that certainly deserves our full attention. The stories, the images, the messages, the information, the entertainment, the values, the advertising that pours into their minds during those 53 hours of media each week really have the potential to shape and affect many different aspects of kids' lives. And I think for all of us who care a lot about kids' healthy development, there's a lot of issues for us to just look at and think about in terms of media use. How can we promote a healthy balance in kids' lives between media and other important activities, whether it's just spending time outdoors or actually talking face-to-face with your parents? How is media multitasking affecting kids? Is it mostly giving them skills that they need to succeed in life? Is it hurting their homework? Is it rewiring their brains? These are issues for us to think about. Are current policies on advertising to children really sufficient in this new media environment? How do we maximize the educational potential of media and new media technology in particular with regard to kids? And are we taking full advantage of all of the various platforms of media as a way to reach young people with important public service messages? How do we balance creative freedom of the artistic community with our very natural urge to want to protect kids from content that we fear might be harmful to them? And similarly, how do we respect young people's independence while still doing our jobs as parents, as educators, as policymakers? Well, we can't answer any of those questions without starting from a solid basis of fact in terms of understanding the role media actually are playing in young people's lives, and that's what this study aims to provide. Our purpose is severalfold. First, we want to provide data for policymakers who are crafting public policies on issues such as media ratings, advertising to children, online safety and privacy, violent or sexual content, promoting educational content, and so on. Second, we hope our data are used to help guide scientific research about the impact of media, both positive and negative, on youth. Third, this work functions as a sort of market research for public health organizations and other nonprofits who are crafting public service campaigns aimed at young people, whether it's on anti-smoking, teen pregnancy prevention, the promotion of fitness and nutrition, and so on. And finally, of course, the study offers a moment for all of us, whether we're parents and educators or media company executives and creators, to step back and take a big picture look at the role of media in young people's lives. So before we get into any of the details, here's what that big picture looks like. By any measure, young people spend a huge amount of time with media. The amount of time devoted to media has increased a lot in recent years, and the rate of increase is going up as well. A number of factors have contributed to this. Just an incremental increase in the number of media platforms in the home and in the bedroom, whether it's TVs, video game consoles, or computers. Continued gradual expansion of home internet access. A lot of multitasking and an explosion in mobile media. Media use really takes off in the tween and early teen years, and African American and Hispanic youth spend a lot more time with media than white kids do. And at least according to their kids, most parents don't set any limits on the amount of time that their kids can spend with media. But among those who do, their kids do spend a lot less time with media. And finally, kids who do spend less time with media tend to do better in school. So before we move into the specifics of our study, it is my great pleasure to introduce the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission for some opening remarks. Julius Genachowski is no stranger to issues concerning kids and media. For one thing, he's got a few of his own, but his involvement in these issues predates his own kids. Special counsel to Commissioner Kennard and chief counsel to Chairman Hunt, he was always a really strong advocate for the concerns of children and one of the key leaders in the country in implementing the Children's Television Act. after he left the FCC for the business side of the media world, he made a decision to stay really involved in issues concerning kids and media. He joined the board of directors of Common Sense Media, which is one of the leaders in the effort to improve the media lives of children and families. He's been a friend and a much-respected colleague for many years. It's my great pleasure to introduce to you now FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski.
Thank you, Vicky, very much. I feel like I've been doing a personal longitudinal study, engaging here with so many people who I was fortunate enough to work with 15 years ago on these issues. That's a good thing. Vicky Rideout, in particular at the Kaiser Foundation and the Kaiser Foundation, playing such a valuable role in focusing attention on the facts and the data and the health effects and what's really happening with kids and technology and media. It's a vital role, critical for policymaking. And I've been doing, as Vicky said, my own longitudinal study, and I think we all have. We all remember the media and communications landscape from when we were kids. And many of us have experiences now watching our kids grow up, seeing the world change. And I think that it's really common to struggle with both the challenges and opportunities of what has been happening. It's been just a time of incredible change, unprecedented change. You know, we remember when we were kids, one TV in the house, a few broadcast channels, a relatively simple set of issues. Today, the world is different. So let me just talk for a few minutes about some of what I see as the challenges and opportunities in this space, and hopefully this will be a helpful setup for this terrific panel that you're going to have. What a great group of people to roll up their sleeves and work on these issues. When I think about the challenges, I think about the following categories: more screens, more time in front of screens, and more dangers from these different screens and the more time in front of screens. So more screens, as I mentioned, you know, one TV in the house when we were in the kids. Now, as Vicky mentioned, mobile phones, computers, video games, a lot more screens that kids are engaging with. And as the study released today shows, a lot more time spent in front of those screens. And also, as the study shows, more dangers and new dangers relating to these activities. I won't try to list them all, but obviously predators in the online world are a new danger. Effects on education that the report documents, effects on childhood obesity, no shortage of dangers to wrestle with, an exacerbation of the challenges that parents have in figuring out how to be good parents in this increasingly complicated world. So real challenges, but at the same time, I think we all look at this explosion of communications and technology and media and see real opportunities. Opportunities around access to new information to help improve education for more people, to enable kids to engage even more with each other, and as they grow up and hit 18, citizens of our country and of the world. These are material opportunities that any set of policies here needs to try to balance. In large measure, this is what we've been focusing on at the FCC, ramping up our efforts under the leadership of Yul Kwan, who is here coordinating our kids' activities, Bill Lake in our media bureau, collectively just extraordinary experience in media and technology and law and dealing with different parts of the landscape. As you might know, several weeks ago, we launched an inquiry into this area. We've actually launched two at this point, one to look at updating the Children's Television Act to see how we can make it more relevant for the digital age, and then second, more broadly, to tackle these questions about the challenges and the opportunities in this new world. The study released today underscores the importance of this effort. It helps illuminate the effort. It identifies facts that are vitally relevant to our effort, and it gives us the opportunity to focus on some of the opportunities. So on the opportunities, I mentioned learning, I mentioned engagement. There are new technology opportunities that I hope we can think about both in the private sector and then to think about what, if anything, we can do in the government to incentivize technologies that can be part of the solution. What do I mean by that? One of the challenges in this area has been how to empower parents to play the role that parents would like to play with respect to their children. Technology can be a part of the answer to this. And when I think about the technology opportunity combined with the economic opportunity, I think that there's real hope. We know why educational and informational programming on broadcast television has historically been a challenge. We know it's been a challenge because the business model lends itself to the opposite. If you have a business model that's premised on aggregating the largest possible audience, it doesn't make sense for folks in that business to wake up every day and say, how exactly can we educate 5 to 8-year-olds? Now, we've decided as a country that broadcasters have to do that anyway, and we have a Children's Television Act and we have FCC rules, and these are very important. But as we implement those, we have to understand that we're fighting against a business model that quite understandably wants to push broadcasters in a different direction, hence the tension and hence progress that's slower than what we would like. One of the opportunities that we have now in the fragmentation of media that we're seeing is the opportunity for new business models to arise that the traditional mass media of broadcasting didn't allow. You know, using the internet with the greater proliferation of cable channels, interactivity, it should be possible. We're seeing some examples of this, of businesses to be built that target smaller audiences and that take advantage of what is a very strong desire on the part of parents to identify technologies that can help their kids. And I'm not saying that the only solution here involves technology and the changing economic incentives, but rather that as we study these issues going forward, we also need to study the changes in technology, the changes in economics, and ask how they can inform changes in policy going forward so that we have at the end an ecosystem of policy, technology, and economics that really serves kids and that honors the First Amendment at the same time. Let me mention one other thing. When we think at the FCC about opportunities and challenges, we think about broadband. And on one hand, today's report confirms that more and more kids are getting connected. But it's also true that too many kids are being left behind. And we recognize that this is complex because of the challenges of being connected, but there's no doubting the opportunities and the necessity of being connected for our kids to grow up and to be economic participants in our 21st century world and to be engaged and informed citizens in our 21st century world. And so making sure that we have broadband policies that connect kids everywhere, whether they live in rural America or inner cities, whether they go to good schools where they're not going to have a problem, or other schools where connectivity provides opportunities to close the educational gap. And so we're focusing on broadband, the opportunities of broadband for kids. We see huge opportunity in the concept of digital literacy. And also as a way to bridge the opportunities and challenges that are in front of us. Empowering kids, making sure that kids have the tools they need to be effective economic actors and citizens in the 21st century, and also so that they understand the dangers and, as they get older, can be responsible consumers of media and communications technology. We can't stop the flow of technology, so we have to focus on policies and activities that channel it in ways that really contribute to our country in the 21st century. And so to all of you, I ask, one, that you pay great attention to this important report, and two, that it inspire you to engage in our processes at the FCC, the processes that we're running on kids, the processes that we're running on broadband. These all relate to each other. It's critical for the country that we get this right. We can't do it without your participation. We're doing everything that we can to open the doors of the FCC to make it easier for non-traditional players to participate in our processes. We're holding open hearings that anyone can participate in. They can do it online. You can send in comments online. We will read plain English submissions, and we will read the kind of data that the Kaiser Foundation has released today. So let me, again, thank the Kaiser Foundation, Vicky Rideout, everyone who worked on the study. Let me thank in advance this panel for being here. It is very important, and we all appreciate it. Working together, we can build an ambitious agenda that empowers parents, enables our kids to ride the digital revolution to new heights, and return home safely. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chairman Jenikowski. So before we go any further this morning, we thought it might be useful and fun to look at just a couple of minutes of media content, just to give us a flavor, set the tone for the day of the kinds of messages and images that young people might be encountering out there in the world of television, the internet, video games, movies, and music. So let's take a look.
It seems today that all you see is violence in movies and sex on TV.
This body of yours just inspired me to do something I have never done before.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know how to start, but
I got a feeling that tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good, good night. I feel it. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good, good night. I feel it. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good, good night. I feel it.
Yasmin, chapter spoken.
Congratulations, you're still in the running towards becoming America's next top model.
Whoa, okay, that is going to kill the blue book value.
Body is 3 to 4 days old. The heat in the trunk is causing the skin to flick.
You're not on Facebook, are you?
No.
MySpace?
No.
LinkedIn?
No.
Twitter?
No.
Friendster?
Okay.
Oh, I love starting out like that. I want to thank our editor, Ann Flatte, who put that tape together for us. And I was inspired at a Green Day theatrical performance of American Idiot, which I think will be coming to Broadway, so you guys got to check it out. It started out in Berkeley. It's really good. So I'm going to start with at the methodology of the study. Field work was conducted by Harris Interactive, and I want to thank Dana Marco and Robin Bell for their many years of participation in this project. Analysis was conducted by Kaiser Family Foundation staff and consultants under the direction of my colleague Ula Four, and with guidance from Professor Don Roberts of Stanford, who you'll meet later. And I also want to thank Melissa Safir, who oversaw all of our work on the media use diaries, which is just a massive amount of data. And I want to say a special thank you to all of the members on the Kaiser team who did these analyses, especially to Liz Hamill, Sarah Cho, who's with us today, and Molly Ann Brody, who helped oversee all of our work on this project. We're also joined today by the person who has the dubious pleasure of proofreading every draft of this report. And I want to say a special hello to Kanani Kauka, who's with us. And of course, I want to thank the person who is my right hand in everything that I do at the foundation and who is homesick with the flu, Teresa Boston. But she's probably watching on our live webcast. And finally, and most importantly, I do want to say a special thank you to the person who established this program area at the foundation. And who has been absolutely steadfast in his commitment to the importance of media and communication as a key part of the foundation's mission, my boss, Matt James, Senior Vice President at the foundation. This is the third in a series of studies that we have conducted at the foundation about young people and media use. Each time period that we've conducted it has included a separate sample of respondents. And this current wave of the survey was in the field from October of 2008 all the way through May of 2009. The study is based on a nationally representative sample of a couple thousand kids between the ages of 8 and 18. We used a written questionnaire administered by trained researchers in the classroom. And in addition to that, more than 700 of the young people volunteered to maintain week-long media use diaries, where they recorded their media use in half-hour increments throughout the day. That allows us to take a closer look at multitasking. Finally, the last point I want to mention is that the study really concerns and focuses on recreational media use only. So when we report total time spent with media, we are not including media used for schoolwork. So we're not, you know, talking about when a kid is using the computer to do a paper or they're researching something online or reading a book as part of their homework. So now to the specifics. This chart shows the amount of time spent with each different medium today in 2009, on average across all 8 to 18-year-olds in the country. It's a total of about 4.5 hours with television, 2.5 with music, 1.5 with computers, a little over an hour with video games, and closer to half an hour each with print and seeing movies in a movie theater. Now, if you add all of that together, you get a total of 10 hours and 45 minutes worth of media content consumed per day. And this is what we call total media exposure. Now, over the years, the amount of young people's total media exposure has gone from about 7.5 hours a day to 8.5 hours in 2004, and now up to more than 10.5 hours worth of media content consumed per day. So in the first 5 years of the study, there was an increase of just about an hour. And in the last 5 years, there's been an increase of more than 2 hours. So if we start from this total media exposure, we have to recognize that a lot of the time that kids are using media, they're actually using more than one medium at the same time. In fact, they're doing that about 29% of their media use time. They're listening to music on their iPod while they're doing their Facebook, or they're surfing the web while they're watching their favorite TV show, and so on. So we start with total media exposure. If you account for the fact that 29% of their media use is spent media multitasking, you get to the actual number of hours out of the day that kids spend using at least one and often more than one type of media, which is what we call total media use, and that is 7 hours and 38 minutes a day. So for about 7.5 hours a day, they're using at least one, maybe often more than one kind of media. This multitasking is something that we have also seen on the rise. The percent of 7th to 12th graders who say that they multitask most of the time that they're using each of these different mediums ranges from a high of 43% who say that about music down to a low of 22% who say that about playing video games. And I have to confess, when we did this study 5 years ago, we, those who wrote the questionnaire, didn't even ask the multitasking question about video games because we just assumed you couldn't multitask while you were playing a video game, which shows how middle-aged and that we are. And then we discovered in the 5 years since then, we witnessed that kids were doing it. There's TVs stacked on top of TVs so that one's used as a monitor for gaming, one's got the television on. There's IMing, lots of stuff going on during video games. One of the most significant changes that we have seen over recent years, the change that really has made it possible, I think, for kids and teens to spend so much more time with media and to multitask so much, has been the absolute explosion in ownership of mobile media platforms. All three of these devices that you see up here on the screen are platforms on which you can consume many different types of media. I think what has really happened is that the content has become really totally disengaged from the platform. So television content doesn't have to be watched on a TV anymore. In fact, if you just look at cell phones, so there's been an increase in, you know, a very substantial increase in the number of kids who own a cell phone, but what the cell phone can do, I mean, it has morphed from being a way to talk to another human being to being a media delivery device. And so today, kids actually spend more time consuming media on their cell phones than they do talking on them. So it's clear from this chart, this is, again, the very first chart that I showed you, that television continues to dominate. It is still by far the largest, the most media that kids consume is television content. But you will notice that that bar on the chart is labeled TV content. And that is because a lot of young people's television, quote unquote television viewing, does not occur on a TV set anymore. So for the first time since we've been doing this study, the amount of time that kids spend watching live television, which we define as watching it on a TV set at the time that it's originally aired, has actually gone down. And it's gone down a fairly significant amount, 25 minutes a day on average. But when you start adding in all of the other ways that kids watch TV, an interesting thing happens. So you start with DVDs, and then you add in time-shifted TV, which is up thanks to mostly to on-demand, but also, of course, to TiVo. And then you add in the time that kids spend watching television online, which has become routine and averages close to half an hour a day among all kids. And then on iPods and cell phones, suddenly you find that kids are spending more time with television content today than they ever have before, thanks to these new platforms. So while live TV was down, total TV content is up. And in fact, young people's viewing today of television, this chart shows you how much of their TV viewing occurs on the different platforms in a proportional sense. It's actually split pretty much 60-40 between traditional live television and then viewing that occurs either on in a time-shifted way or on other platforms. The next most popular media activity is music and other audio. And you can see here that time spent in this activity held steady for the first 5 years of the study, and then, boom, a big increase, 47 minutes a day over the last 5 years. Why? Because of iPods, cell phones, and iTunes. And so today, about two-thirds of all of kids' music listening occurs on these relatively new formats that really were not even in widespread use 5 years ago. Computer use is up quite a bit as well. From about half an hour when we started to an hour in 2004 and now an hour and a half. And there are really two different factors that account for that. One is the continued expansion in home internet access. And then the other is just the development of a whole bunch of new applications that just really appeal to kids and speak to them, like social networking and YouTube and so forth. So the percent of kids with home internet access is now at 84% across all kids. The quality and speed of that access has gone up as well, to the point now where nearly 6 in 10 have high-speed access at home. And the percent with internet access in their bedroom has continued to go up gradually as well. Now, if you look at what young people do on the computer, and again, this analysis is limited to non-school-related activities on the computer, you can really see that it's three primary functions that occupy most of their time. It's social networking, playing games, and video sites like YouTube. So to video game use, that has also increased substantially over the years. The increase that we see over the last 5 years, I think, is primarily due, again, to newer mobile platforms, especially being able to use the iPod, which is so popular now, and being able to use cell phones for gaming. I was a little surprised not to see console gaming increase. You can see here we break out the differences, the changes over the last 5 years in console game playing, which has held relatively steady, and handheld gaming, which has gone up. And most of that increase is not on things like the Nintendo DS. It's on iPods and cell phones. So even with new consoles like the Wii or new games like Guitar Hero and Rock Band, the console gaming stayed pretty steady. Somewhat surprisingly, one thing that has not changed is that there continues to be a big gender gap when it comes to video games. And this shows you the difference now in 2009 between boys and girls in terms of the average amount of time spent playing video games in a typical day. And you'll see that, you know, the casual gaming, there's, you know, a modest difference in the handheld players, not so much on the cell phones. But in console gaming, there continues to be a really big gap. Boys between the ages of 8 and 18 in this country spend an average of about an hour a day sitting down and playing games at a console player. But girls spend less than 15 minutes a day doing that. The one medium that has not seen an increase over the past 10 years is reading in print. And there's actually been a small decrease over the past 10 years. But this broader trend masks some interesting differences in terms of the types of reading. So if we break it out and look at books, magazines, and newspapers, this chart shows you the progression over the 10 years of the study. The decrease is entirely in magazines and newspapers. The amount of time that kids spend reading books in a typical day for pleasure has actually increased slightly over the past 10 years. But what has happened is that there's actually just a much smaller proportion of kids who spend any time at all reading magazines or newspapers in a typical day. So this chart shows you the percent of kids who say they spent any time reading books, magazines, or newspapers outside of schoolwork the previous day. So the percent who read books has just been rock steady. But with magazines and newspapers, you see a pretty steep decline. And I think it was pretty surprising to look back and think that in 1999, 42% of kids between the ages of 8 and 18 said that they had looked at a newspaper the previous day. Now it's down to 23%. Some of them are now reading newspapers and magazines online, and you'll find the statistics and specifics about that in the report. It's not yet a mainstream activity. It averages out to about 2 minutes a day across all kids. So finally, I want to talk about a couple of the bigger trends that we see in the data. And the first one has to do with the big explosion in media use that we see when kids hit the tween years. So right around 11, 12, 13 years old. The amount of time that kids spend with television, music, computers, and video games goes up a lot at this point. And I think that's important just because the tween years seem to be a pretty important time in kids' development. It's a time when they're really figuring out who they are and how they fit in and what everybody else is doing. And all of a sudden, they're being exposed to about 4 more hours a day of media content. And so I think that's just an important period of time, an important age group for us to think about and consider. There's also not a ton of media content that is created specifically for that age group, so I suspect that a fair amount of the time that they're using media, they're consuming media that's maybe really created for an age group slightly older than what they are. It comes to a total of 4 hours, as you can see in this chart here that compares total media exposure by age group. The other thing that stands out is that there are substantial differences in total media exposure between children of different races and ethnicities. So Black and Hispanic kids consume about 4.5 hours more media a day than white kids do. And these differences did hold when we controlled for other possible important variables like the age of the child, the gender, the parent's education, whether it was a single parent or two-parent household, and so on. We did still see a difference. Not only that, but these differences have grown over time. So in 1999, you can see the racial and ethnic differences in this chart. There was a disparity in media use. It was about 2 hours a day between white kids and black kids in terms of total media exposure. But now in 2009, that has really doubled to more than 4.5 hours. So I think that it just seems like something's going on here that might be worth taking a closer look at. We also found a negative relationship between the amount of time that kids spend with media and the kind of grades that they report getting. So you can see on the left-hand side of this chart, this pie chart, the percent of kids who say that they get mostly fair or poor grades, which is C's or below. So this pie chart shows the light media users, the kids who spend the least time with media. This is the moderate media users, and this is the heavy media users, where close to half say they get mostly C's or below. Again, this relationship between media use and grades did hold when we controlled, again, for other variables that we thought might be relevant. Single-parent versus two-parent families, race and ethnicity, parent education, age, gender, and so on. A study like this, a cross-sectional study like this, really cannot tell us if this is a causal relationship. And even if it were a causal relationship, we wouldn't know which direction it ran in. But despite that, it does seem like a strong association. And again, it's something that we want to take a look at, and it seems like it's worth us thinking about and certainly noting. I think it's especially relevant because of the other finding we have in the study, where we ask kids how often they're using media when they're doing their homework. And what you find is among all kids 8 to 18, it's a little over half of them who say that's something that they do either most or some of the time. If you look at the kids who say most of the time they're using media while they're doing their homework, it's about a little under a third of all kids, and that might be watching TV in the background, listening to music, IMing, or whatever. So the final point that I want to make is that parents do appear to have a good bit of influence over the amount of time that their kids spend with media. Every day, parents are making a series of decisions that really affect the media environment in their home, whether it's how many televisions and video game consoles they're going to have there, if they're going to be in their kids' bedrooms, if they're going to turn them on during meals, if they're going to set rules or limits about the amount of time, and so on. So today, for example, 64% of kids say that the television is usually on during their home during meals. 45% say the TV is usually left on most of the time in the background, whether anybody's watching it or not. 71% say they have a television set of their own in their bedroom. And this chart shows you the percent who say they have some kind of rules about the amount of time they can spend with each of these media. So in each case, it's about 60% to up to 85% who say they don't have any rules about the amount of time that they can spend with each medium. And I will say this is according to the kids. But the kind of media environment that's created in the home does have a strong relationship with the amount of time that kids spend using media. So, for example, kids who live in a home where the television is left on most of the time, whether anybody's watching it or not, they watch live television for about an hour and a half more than kids who live in a home where that just doesn't happen. Kids with a TV in their bedroom spend about an hour a day more watching live TV than kids who don't have a TV in their bedroom. And then the kids who don't have any media rules at all spend close to close to three hours a day more media than the kids who have at least one rule, who have some kind of media rules about their media use. Could be about time, could be about content, anything from any kind of guidance from the parents about that. So speaking about parents and kids, when you do a study like the one that we've done here today, you're talking inevitably about averages. In fact, that's kind of the point, is to take the big picture look at the average across the country. But every kid is an individual. They all have their own likes and dislikes, their quirks and their peculiarities. So we sent our video cameras into a few homes to invite the kids and their parents to share with us their own media use habits. And so let's take a look into the media lives of three real kids, the kind of kids who are behind the averages and the statistics that we're talking about here today.
I like to text and listen to music at the same time. But I usually travel down to the computer, so I usually am on the computer waiting for a text while listening to music.
I will be just playing Xbox, playing FIFA. you know, like trying to score goals and listening to my iPod or hooking up the iTunes and just, you know, cranking up the stereo. I'll be changing games all the time. I'll be texting my friends, you know, sitting there on my chair just relaxing. And then I'll switch to my computer or go on YouTube, maybe get off, I don't know, go on Pinnacle or, you know, just check out some new sites my friends tell me about. You know, I mean, I do everything at once.
I'm always texting, always looking at TV. If it's not texting and looking at TV, it's computer and listening to my iPod, or talking on the phone and looking at TV or something. It's always crashing into each other. If I know I'm going to miss a show or if I just want to record it just to go back and watch it, I record it and I can just go back and watch it over and over and over how many times I want to.
I usually spend my weekends watching TV all the time, and I DVR all my shows during the week so I just have a huge list of shows that I need to watch. They have TV shows on the internet like Hulu, and sometimes YouTube has videos on, and it's just like watching TV, but not at the TV.
On the weekdays, I would play like 6 hours. On the weekends, maybe like 10 or 11. Like, I play a lot, you know. I'm not addicted, you know, it's fun.
He was extremely obsessed with it, and he had no control. I had to tell him when to get off, when to get on, and all that. But with time, he's gotten the hang of it. He manages it with other stuff. So as long as he's responsible on his own, I don't mind.
I'll just sit up, I'll get my Dr. Pepper, sugary foods, you know, I'll just drink it up, eat it up, go to the bathroom. The bathroom's right here, so it's very convenient. I just get up, I go, you know, get back up, just play. That's all I do. I never stop playing.
I use my computer every day, 4 hours. I can go on and on more than that.
I usually use my computer a lot, and I'm on the internet a lot, and usually YouTube and my email are my main sources, but it depends what I'm doing.
Well, you know, we just don't see that many issues, so we have limits, but I don't think they're sort of draconian, or we don't strictly enforce them. I mean, the computer thing can be sort of, you've been at the computer for like 4 hours today. I think that's enough. You know, get her to go do something else.
I don't use my computer that much for the web, like just YouTube and, like, you know, Facebook and all that.
I have Facebook on my cell phone. I could look up research a word or just do anything on my phone. I do download music onto my phone if I'm just in a rush or I don't have my iPod, or I'll just listen to my music that's on my cell phone, and this is just all in one. I'm texting and listening to music, jamming at the same time.
I probably send like 500 text messages to my friends a week.
Text messages coming in and going out like 200, a day.
A couple thousand texts a day, I guess, you know. I don't know, I always use it, like my inbox gets full, I just erase and keep on going.
If I have a conversation over text, it can go on and on, but if I'm on the phone with somebody, they're just boring. Just keep talking about nothing.
If it's regular homework that I'm doing, I probably will just like do it while I'm like, I don't know, like listening to music or maybe watching TV.
If I'm looking at the TV, I'm doing my homework, and that is it makes an impact on my grades. I mean, if somebody sends me a text message while I'm doing my homework, it's a distraction.
I've had my grades get worse. When I first bought my phone on unlimited plans, I wasn't focusing, so they went drastically down, but then I've kind of calmed down a bit, and my grades have gotten better because I've studied more and focused more on my homework. But before, I was just constantly texting and constantly on the computer when I first got it.
Well, my method is, you know, I don't study, I just pay attention in class as hard as I can. Studying is just like wasting Xbox time. I'm like multimedia tasks all the time. Like, I didn't even know I was doing it. Now I do. I feel special.
Well, I want to thank especially Renato Perez, who put that video together for us, and Jackie Judd. and everybody on the Kaiser staff who volunteered their godchildren and neighbors to be in the video for us. So as I said at the top of my presentation, now that we have some facts about young people's media use, there are a lot of questions and a lot of issues for us to think about. So we're going to at least start that conversation here today with an extraordinary group of people who are intimately involved in many different facets of the issues concerning kids and media. So at this point, it's my great pleasure to turn the discussion over to my colleague here at the Kaiser Family Foundation, former ABC News correspondent Jackie Judd, and she's going to introduce our panelists and ask them to come up and take their seats as she introduces them.
Okay. Thanks, Vicki, and good morning, everyone. Please join me up on the stage now, if you would. There are extensive bios in your folders, so I'm going to just briefly introduce our panel. Starting over on your right is Stephen Friedman, who has been with MTV for a little over a decade now. MTV, as you know, is the leading multimedia brand for young people, and he is currently general manager of MTV. Don Roberts, sitting next to him, has been with Stanford since 1968 in a number of capacities. His research, as you heard earlier today, focuses on how young people use and respond to the media, to mass media, and he is a co-author of the report. Rich Taylor is Senior Vice President of Communications and Industry Affairs at the Entertainment Software Association here in Washington. It is a trade group that represents the interactive gaming industry. Linda Birch is a co-founder and the Chief Education and Strategy Officer of Common Sense Media. You also heard about them earlier today, an organization focused on improving the media lives of kids and families. They're multitasking up there. Michael Rich is Director of the Center on Media and Child Health and is an Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the Harvard Medical School. So welcome to you all. Steve, I'm going to start with you. I'm sure that internally MTV has its own data, so I'd like to get your response about what Vicki outlined in the report. Does it ring true? And if it does, what's your reaction?
Hit that. It absolutely rings true. I think it's consistent with what we see. We talk to the audience in a number of ways every day. And this audience was pretty much raised connected. They're the chief technology officers of their family. I think their parents go to them to figure things out. And that really impacts everything we do because they're consuming media differently, which means development, programming. Our pro-social campaigns all have to change as they're really rapidly changing. So I think it absolutely rings true to what we see.
Does it make it easier or more difficult to reach them because even though they're connected, there's so much clutter?
It's a good question. It's sometimes tougher to reach them. I think, though, there is also a real upside because if you partner with them, speak in their voice and kind of platforms that they are much more familiar with than we are, you can have a much deeper conversation, especially on some of the pro-social campaigns we've done. We've really gone to them to say, how do you address this issue? They have a sophistication in these new media spaces and in creating media that have kind of dazzled us. So I think we're really learning from them in how we communicate.
Don Roberts, you've been involved in this report with Vicki. And I think 5 years ago, it may have been you who said, we reached a ceiling. Yeah. Kids couldn't possibly find more time in their day to be connected. Well, guess what?
I should have been.
So how historic a moment is this? And what are the implications of what we're found?
This is a game changer. 5 years ago I wrote a very learned piece on how we'd finally hit a ceiling on use. Probably with multitasking and exposure was going to go up, but use, you know, no one could possibly spend more than 6.5 hours a day with media. And then they miniaturized and mobilized all these platforms, and we're really close to, you know, kids being online 24/7. There's a line in the report about kids going to sleep with a iPhone under their pillow, and they do. Mm-hmm. And if they get lonely, they reach under their pillow and they're back online again. And it seems to me it really is a new world. If you look, I've been doing this kind of research for 40 some odd years. And the research is really across platforms. We have research on television and research on radios and research on computers. And it's all sort of moot now because the platform differences just don't exist. There's this little thing you can carry around in your hand and you read from it and you listen to it and you look at it and you play games on it, and that's going to be true of all of these platforms. It may be in your bedroom, maybe in your front pocket, maybe in the living room. So a lot of the distinctions we used to make are gone. And the other thing that's gone is much of media were designed for individuals to sit down, sometimes in a social situation, to consume, right? You know, we went to the movies, we were kind of alone because it was dark. When we watched television, we sat with our families. We now have kids who, for the standard operating procedure, is to sit and watch a television program while texting about the television program to friends that they've probably never met, who are some of their closest friends. And we know that changing the social situation changes the way people process information. You all know that you look at a television show differently. If you watch something with sex in it at your age, you watch it differently and think about it differently if you're there alone or with another adult or if there's a 12-year-old girl with you. You really do think about it differently. Well, that's happening with these kids sharing as they go across these various platforms. So we're changing the way kids are processing. We're changing the way they're organizing socially. And to me, it's just suddenly we have to sit back and reassess and say, wow, we don't even know what some of the questions are, I think.
And so using what Don said as a launching point, Michael Rich, you're a pediatrician. How do you view this as a health issue, and why is it a concern as a health issue for children?
Based on the research we've had, and there has been research even before Don, for about a good body of research for about 50 years, at least on the effects of violence, but on a number of different effects. We are seeing in admittedly cross-sectional studies associations between things like exposure to violence and increased anxiety in kids, exposure to violence and increased desensitization to the suffering of others, a relationship between screen time and obesity, and a relationship between viewing highly sexually charged material and earlier sexual debuts, as we call it so neatly in medicine. But I think that what we don't know is how these are related. Are these causal? Are they contributing? Or are they just markers for something that's already going on? And so I think that this gives rise to concern both among pediatricians and among parents that are aware of this. But I think we still need a lot of work in understanding what these mechanisms are because, as Vicky aptly said, I think we have to shift from looking at exposure to media as a social issue or as a values-based or what's right and wrong issue to an issue of their physical, mental, and social health. And parents need to know what is going into their kid's head as much as they need to know what's going into their kid's body in terms of raising that child effectively to be a healthy and whole person.
But is it fair to ask in that context whether all of this media use and the multitasking also may have some positive outcomes? Does it make them more nimble? Does it make them more mentally flexible?
Absolutely. And does it educate them? Does it make them more greater participants in our democracy, our world and global democracy, in a sense? Absolutely. We have research that indicates there's some very positive effects, everything from educational TV to the values of social networking sites. The problem is that we don't know how all these data fit together. Mm-hmm. And we don't know there are clearly differences in what happens with some kids using some media and some media content and other kids using either the same media content or other media content. And we don't have the knowledge yet to understand what these effects are, how they work, and how we can use them to promote the things we want for our kids as opposed to the things we're scared about for our kids.
Rich, we've heard a lot this morning already about parents. Representing the gaming industry, what do you hear, know, feel about what parents are doing to monitor their kids' usage?
It really does vary. Actually, I'm struck. I have to tell you, I leaned over to Stephen and said this. That video the kids came on I was like, wait, I teach her in Sunday school. There's one. And I was like, where's my shout out? Why did I give any talking points ahead of time? Why was I not warned? Anyway, to your
now
question.
Now you know what she's doing under her desk.
I
she's
do. It's like, maybe I should see, you know, it's a line from a movie where it's like, you know, seeing your teacher in the mall is like seeing a dog walking on his hind legs. It's just something just weird about, there's something weird about seeing my Sunday school student in that kind of form. But anyway, I digress. To your question. Well, it's interesting because the looking mainly, let's look at the platforms, your Xbox, PlayStation, Nintendo. The manufacturers of those have actually done a great number of activities to both educate parents and provide tools, for instance, be it timers, be it ratings controls. So, you know, there's an effort to arm parents, if you will, no pun intended, with the ability to take increased control over how what is consumed in their home and how. Of course, we have a ways to go in terms of, you know, making sure they are fully aware of these and are making use of them,
right,
educational
so
efforts on that front.
How extensively they're
to
being
the extent,
used?
I mean, you know, it's similar, you know, not similar, but it's, you know, the V-chip comes to mind, yeah. And Vicky and I both, we're actually each 21 years old, but the V-chip makes us look a bit older because we went through that together. And, you know, it is a situation where every TV set has this. Well, how many folks are using it? How many are aware of it? You know, how do they know, how to set it? Is it standardized across the board and how to do so? And it is a frustration because there are many, many assets available to sort of, if a parent looks at a situation and says that's too much that my child is consuming, or that's the wrong kind of thing I'm consuming, there are the bits and pieces out there for them to utilize. Industry has a role to play in making sure they know about it, an increased role to play, and we're trying to do more on that front, speaking from behalf of the video game industry. But there's a lot of work to be done across the board to make sure parents are aware of what's out there already, and a lot more to do to help, you know, equip them even more so in the future.
Linda, there is this contradiction that we've heard about this morning, that on the one hand, parents say they're terribly concerned about how their kids are connected and how many hours they spend, but on the other hand, the rules aren't in place. What do you make of that?
Well, I think what's interesting is that there are some parents who really are setting rules. And what the study shows is that it makes a huge difference. It matters dramatically. At Common Sense Media, over 1 million parents per month come to our site to look at ratings and reviews on media content, but also to get parent advice on new digital media. That being said, those statistics are dramatic, and more needs to be done. I think one of the reasons that parents don't set rules, there are many of them, but the most important one is that they really don't understand what their kids are doing. We did a study a few months ago, a Common Sense Media study, where we asked teens how much time they were spending on social networking sites, how many of them went on more than 10 times per day, and they said the answer was 31%. When we asked parents the same question, only 4% knew that their kids were going on social networking sites that often. So there's a huge disconnect in terms of what parents know. I think there's also the issue around using media as an electronic babysitter. It still exists. Mm-hmm. I also believe that we are in a world and a time in which, you know, parents are using media really extensively as well, and it's very hard at times to say, I'm going to turn off my BlackBerry. I am going to turn off the television set where I've time-shifted the show 24 so that I can see it at 8 o'clock. So there's a need for parents to just be more responsible. And then finally, I think parents are just really overwhelmed by the 24/7 nature of media, the total barrage, and they need very, very simple advice and tools. So all of the tools that are out there need to be simple. They need to be explained very easily to parents. And in addition, parents need education. We need it in the schools. We need it in our homes. We need it in our communities. So they realize the impact that media is having on kids' social and emotional and physical health and know how to steer and guide them in this digital age.
Michael, what's the advice that pediatricians give parents about how much time is a healthy amount of time? What advice is there?
It depends on the pediatrician. I think probably many of you in the group here are, how many are parents here? How many of you have had your pediatrician talk about media? Okay, this is pretty typical. We're not doing a good job of it. And I would add to what Linda says, which is that I think parents are both clueless about what their kids are doing, but they're clueless about what their kids are doing, maybe doing to their kids. And I think that we have a long way to go, both in the research realm, as we've talked about earlier, about knowing whether these are causal or contributory effects. And so we need to do longitudinal studies, which we're only just starting to do now, following kids over time for a variety of health outcomes. But I think that what's happening is that pediatricians are, like most in medicine, getting crunched and having less and less and less time actually with the kids. They are, you know, overwhelmed with the things they have to do with immunizations and car seats and bicycle helmets and all these things, all of which are actually very good examples of how a word from a pediatrician can make a huge difference in a kid's life because they're getting in the car seats. They're putting on the bike helmets. But we're not getting the word out because it has not risen high enough on the priority scale of the pediatrician to get into that 7-minute
visit.
They don't
view it as part of their portfolio, right?
I think there's some of that. I think there's some of that. And there's also pushback from some parents who say, why are you trying to tell me how to run my kids' lives? We get that with seatbelts, too. You know, don't tell me to use a seatbelt. It's none of your damn business. But I think that it's really more the fact that they don't see it as enough of a problem to get above, did you get H1N1 vaccine or whatever the crisis du jour is. And I think one of the interesting things about one of the few studies we have about pediatricians talking to parents about media is – one, the women are much better than the men are. Women pediatricians are much better than the men are. And there's a direct inverse relationship between how much media the pediatrician uses and how likely they are to talk about media use.
Jackie, could I just jump in for one second? I think it's really interesting to think about parents, and it's important to acknowledge that parents may just have a really different opinion about their kids and media use than pediatricians or than some child development folks have. Because you see parents like in the video who say, you know, when she's spent 4 hours on the computer, will say, you know, well, maybe that's enough time on the computer. And there may be, you know, maybe their pediatrician or somebody else would say, maybe that's too much. So I think that's something to really acknowledge and respect. And if the recommendations of the pediatricians are truly important from a health perspective, then it's something that we need to do a much better job of communicating. The other thing that, of course, leaps out from the video is just that some parents seem to be a little less in tune with exactly what their kids are doing.
Right.
Like when you have a young man saying, I just spent all of my time playing games, and the mom saying, he's got a really good balance in his life and everything's fine. So there might be a little bit of a disconnect.
Right, and parents, I think, typically, someone up here already said this, that parents are a bit behind the curve in their knowledge. I remember a few years back in our house, we had a rule, no TV during the school week, and we went into one of our kids' bedrooms one night, and they were watching a TV show on their laptop. And they looked at us and said, that's not a TV, Mom. Yes.
Parents have always been clueless. I mean, be honest. I mean, when you were 12, weren't you looking at things and reading things that your parents didn't know? For years, we've had parents giving us estimates of their children's television viewing time, and then you go talk to the child, and the kids would say, you know, I've never even seen that show. So the big change to me that is going on now is that there are so many more things and so many more ways in which to be clueless. That sounds funny, but just the idea. In our first study 10 years ago, we were stunned when we learned that 66%, at that time, two-thirds of all kids had, between the ages that we looked at, had a television in their bedroom.
Right.
14% of our two-year-olds had a television set in their bedroom. Why on earth would you put a television set in a two-year-old's bedroom? Pediatricians are telling parents, those that are talking, that your kid shouldn't even be looking at television until he or she is three, isn't it? Three? Two? Okay. Well, then, oh, maybe that's why they put it in. They're two now. That's the answer. And And one of the things that I think concerns me most is that we have made our kids, well, we've made each other, our adults too, but we are so independent in terms of what's happening in terms of media coming down the pipe. We used to talk about the fact Sesame Street worked very hard in the first few years to build the kind of programming that would hold parents. Because one thing we knew was that if an adult sat and watched Sesame Street with a three-year-old, the adult could not help him or herself from teaching. You talked to the kid. You interacted with the kid. You pointed at things on the screen. And the idea of the teachable moment. Kids could learn a great deal from television, particularly when there was an adult there to point at things and to help them learn it. What we've done now is cut this apart more and more and more.
So, Linda, give us three quick pieces of advice that parents could do right away to maybe alter the environment.
Yeah, I think first of all, you have to accept that this technology is all around and it is not going to go away. We cannot cover kids' eyes. We can teach them how to see. So we have to embrace their world. We have to get knowledgeable. We have to do our homework. That's number one. So get involved, understand their world, ask them questions. Number two, I think the idea of co-viewing and co-experiencing and co-gaming is really an important one because that is the arena in which you can impart your own values and can become the most important guide in your kid's media life. So I think things like the Wii becoming a big platform is great because kids and parents are playing it. Guitar Hero, I was really encouraged to see the statistics on the video game popularity in the Kaiser Family Foundation report with Guitar Hero and Super Mario being above Grand Theft Auto. That's great. So number two is I think you need to get involved and engage. Ask your kid to show you their video that they've uploaded to YouTube or their Facebook profile. Know what they're doing, number two. And then I think number three, you have to set rules. I mean, if there was one thing incredibly compelling in this report, it's that setting the rules does matter, and they are simple, whether it is content, what you can see or not see. Number two, it is, you know, time limits do make sense. And then these basic advice that we've been giving for years of not having media in the bedroom, not having texting and TV viewing during meal times. Think about what you do in the car. Preserve that time to talk if you can instead of let your kids text, etc. I think there's a school in Philadelphia that I love that was dealing with this issue of, you know, the middle schoolers dragging into school just exhausted. And finally the head of school pulled the parents together and said, "We know what's happening. These kids are on their computers or their cell phones all night long. They hear a little bleep, they get up, they text back." And the head of the school said, "Tell me what you're going to do about this, parents. Come up with some solutions." And the group came up with something they call CCC911, which is a computer, cell phone, I can't remember what the next C is, curfew, that's what it is, where all of the parents send a text or an email to their kids saying it's 9 o'clock, time for these things to be turned off. They plug them in, they get recharged overnight. The entire community did it as a whole, and it's made a profound difference. So I think those are the simple answers. Get knowledgeable, get involved, and, you know, be a parent, set some limits. Michael, quickly.
Add one thing. I think a key word that Vicky said in her discussion of this is it's parents' opinion. Parents' opinions vary. And I want to do a little rewind back to when parents had opinions that smoking wasn't so bad or that junk food wasn't so bad. So I really think that part of our job here is to shift this from an opinion piece or something about my values aren't, you know, abrogated by this and make it not about values but about outcomes, physical, mental, and social health outcomes, and give parents the facts and the strategies for translating those facts into good parenting.
Steve and Rich, let's move on to actual content now. We've been talking more, I think, about the quantity that kids consume, but the content.
there's obviously a lot of concern about the barrage of messages that kids get, either of a sexual nature, how to behave, what's cool, what's not cool. In the development of your creative at MTV, how much of these concerns occupy your time when you're working with the producers, and what kind of lines do you draw?
Well, I think, you know, we take our standards very seriously, and I think have to look at each show, and everything that goes on air goes through a very strict set of standards. But I think, given this changing audience, one of the things that both Donald and Linda touched on is this issue of co-viewing, which means creating very different content. And you look at Hispanic youth in particular, they're leading the charge in terms of co-viewing, where they are downloading or TiVoing programming to watch it with their parents. So a show that we put on recently called World's Strictest Parents. Now, 10 years ago, no one would have imagined we would have put that on MTV. But with this audience at 6 o'clock, because we tried it at 10, it didn't work at 10. But at 6 o'clock, it did incredibly well for us. And we're finding now that we've got to shift our programming because at a certain time, kids are speaking with their parents. And I think Michael made the point that the power of the parents. I think what we're finding is for the millennial generation, their parents are their heroes. And I think they have a lot more
really?
Leverage. They really are. When we asked them, we did a happiness study to find out what makes them, gives them kind of the biggest happiness they have. We did it with the AP last year. Number one was listening to music, no surprise. Mm-hmm. Number two, and tied 2-3, was their relationship with their parents. Number three was their friends. So I think we are at this moment where it impacts programming because parents have a very critical role, and what they say has a real impact in what their kids consume.
But let me just press you on this question one more time, and that is, what kind of content lines won't you cross? What show proposals have you been brought that you say, no way?
A lot. Too many to discuss here. I think, you know, I'll give you an example of a show that when I heard, you know, we've got a series called True Life, where it's been a series that we just really look at a subculture or a specific experience from young people. And our team started talking about this rise of teen pregnancies. And you look at shows like, you look at Juno, and you look at different examples, and you look at some of the young stars that we profile having kids early. And so we started looking at that, a show called 16 Pregnant, and that could cut both ways, depending on how you handled that. We married kind of the programming team with our pro-social department, brought in the national campaign to end teen pregnancy. And if you watch this show, which has become a hit for us, it does better ratings than The Hills, you know, which is a more well-known franchise. It speaks to a show that could have gone the wrong direction. But in fact, if you watch the show, you realize these kids' lives end. They're no longer kids. They're parents. And it is a tough life that they are having to grapple as 16-year-olds. And so I think that's an example where it can cut both ways depending on how mm-hmm. you move it forward. And what we try to do is create those teachable moments when you can. Some shows like Jackass, you're never going to have a teachable moment. You're not. But I think there are others where you can do it.
Rich, can you take up some of these questions about content, what you feel the responsibility of the industry is and what lines won't be crossed?
A little bit of a different position at the ESA versus MTV, which is a producer of content versus a organization that represents a broad industry. We don't tell the publishers and developers what they can and can or should and should not make. We do obviously have the ESRB rating system, which is extraordinarily robust. The most recent FTC report said it was basically outpacing other industries in terms of providing parents with information and at the enforcement level as well. So we're very proud of that. That's sort of where we enter this equation of how can we sort of, you know, let you know what content is in various games. At the retailer level, you know, if it's an M-rated game, when it's scanned, it says ask for ID on the scanner at the retailer level, so that even at that point of purchase, there's another barrier there. If a kid tries to purchase a game without a parent present, there should be a stopgap there as well, and we're found high levels of enforcement there. So, you know, in our environment, you know, we just basically try and tell parents, okay, here's the rating. Here's what's in it. We give great amount of detail about the type of things you might encounter in a game, We've got everything from widgets to apps to everything else to try and get it in front of parents as often and as current as possible. To, you know, if you're in the Target or the Best Buy, you have an ability right on the spot to find out, you know, what is going on with this game before you make a purchase decision. That's sort of where we come into a content question.
Okay. Towards the end of Vicky's presentation, she highlighted some of the interesting nuggets, the interesting findings, among them being the tweens. Linda, what is your read about why kids who are at that age suddenly have this explosion in media use, and what are your concerns?
Well, I think it's a very interesting finding. In fact, I think it's one of the most important findings, because I think this age group of 11 to 14, it's a moment in time when kids are beginning to exert their independence. It's a moment in time where the peer norms are incredibly important. You combine that with what's happened with technology, where essentially the mobile device has become a personal portal for these kids to every piece of content out there in the world, and which is why I think the industry has a really big responsibility to think about what they're putting out there, because now kids can access it 24/7 everywhere. But what you've got here is this very vulnerable group of kids who now have the ability to text and to go online and to use technology in ways that are both consuming and creating. At a moment in time where their brains haven't quite developed in terms of judgment, where the peer pressure is enormous, and where the new technology can amplify that peer norm dramatically because everybody's connected to everyone. So I think it's something we have to pay profound attention to as parents, as policymakers, as educators. That is why we, Common Sense Media, in focusing our education efforts, are creating digital citizenship curriculum for 5th through 8th graders, because we think that's the moment in which they need to understand what the ramifications are in terms of the content they could come across, but it's almost more importantly how they behave with this new medium where they can communicate and connect with everyone. So the reason why I think they become big consumers, I think the mobile element is huge. Mm-hmm. And it's also the moment in time where technology is introduced in schools, one-to-one laptop programs, you know, so that blurring of lines between what is education, what is entertainment, is very complicated. We have to focus on this age group on all fronts. It's really important, because if we do, and these kids begin to understand both the perils and the possibilities and can learn to navigate on their own, by the time they reach high school and are launched beyond that, we're going to be in good shape. But if we miss that moment where parents still have a little bit of influence and where educators have a lot of influence, I believe, then we've lost an opportunity that's really huge.
Rich, I want you to jump in on this, but just let me ask Don one quick question. 5 years from now, will you be surprised if if the age is even younger? Where what's now 11 will be 8.
I would be surprised, okay, if the age changes. In fact, that peak, we started writing about that peak as early as 1965, 66. That's been pretty constant. And it has to do with available time and the other demands on children's lives. Schools change, this kind of thing. What happens is you see these kids get more and more freedom around 12. And in fact, if you go into different school systems, places where middle school starts in the 6th grade or the 7th grade or the 8th grade, you can see the peak move. Mm-hmm. And it's a function of what other demands are made. And then as the kids get a little bit older, there are many more demands in the high school, and they're given the car keys, and they discover the other sex, and all sorts of things take over. And it declines until you get to be my age, and then your available time goes up like this again, and you watch more.
Rich?
I just have very interested in your digital citizenship curriculum, which I applaud in every way possible. I was curious, does it have a parental component to it, since what you spoke about before? I think it'd be interesting to see how what the kids carry home that engages the parents.
Absolutely. We believe that really everybody's got to become a great digital citizen. parents, teachers, and kids, and there has to be a strong homeschool connection. The adult mentors in kids' lives are not only parents. In some families, they are older siblings, they are grandparents, they are, you know, youth educators. And so parents and teachers have to be on the same page, and they have to be communicating with kids. And so this is a whole community approach to a curriculum. Vicki?
Well, yeah, I was actually just going to ask Stephen to talk a little bit about the efforts that you're taking at MTV, where you're working on the digital abuse campaign and the athinline.org, because MTV has actually started to tackle these issues of cyberbullying and sexting and sort of digital citizenship themselves. So if you could talk about what you're doing and why.
Sure. I mean, one of the things I think that we've all talked about is these multiple ways to connect and consume media and discuss the media create more opportunities for digital abuse, mm-hmm. whether it's sexting or cyberbullying. And we've seen these brutal examples. There was a kid, Abraham Biggs, you guys are probably aware of, who online live was bullied literally to death. And you know that if these kids had been in the same room with this young man, they never would have done it. But mm-hmm. behind the screen, there is a separation that they don't really get the repercussions of their actions. And because of that, the fact that 80% of them had experienced some kind of abuse, 50% said they were victims, and 30% said they had either received or sent a sext. Really, for us, meant a new level of bullying that is playing out among this audience in some cases very hostile environment, because there's no check. There's not a code of ethics yet around it. And so we created a campaign, A Thin Line, with a number of organizations to figure out how do we work with them to define those moral codes in this space and what it means to send a naked picture of yourself to your boyfriend, hoping that he's not going to send it to everyone. And interestingly, TV and the video medium, video of any kind, can be a very powerful way to get that message across. Because when they're behind the screen typing, I don't know that they always understand the repercussions. So we launched that about a month ago and have on Valentine's Day a big show coming out on sexting.
I visited the site yesterday, and it's pretty deep. Just briefly share with us some of the advice you're giving the kids.
Well, I think the biggest point is to get them to understand that they are unwittingly creating a really hostile situation out there for some people. And the ease of use of forwarding has deep repercussions. Mm-hmm. And the kid that forwards it doesn't understand that he could be violating a federal policy on child predatory laws. And so I think just educating them to the repercussions, I think, is the main message. Because we don't want to come in as teachers. We really want to give them the tools to combat it. The other final thing I'll say on it is, like our Darfur campaign, like our mental health campaign, we feel like our audience has better solutions than we will ever know. So we have a grant of about $75,000 where we're now asking them, what are the tools that you would create? Is it a fig leaf to go on the photo? You know, we figure, what is the app you would do? And mm-hmm. so we're going to them and asking the question now.
I have to say, I think it's really interesting that you're, for your digital abuse campaign, the platform that makes the most sense for you to use is television. And then, but for other public education campaigns that, like GYT, which you do with the Kaiser Foundation, it's more of a texting campaign, and just now that you're using lots of different platforms for different types of campaigns.
I want to open it up to the audience in just a moment, but before we do, Vicki, I want to turn to you a question. One of the issues you've studied in the past, and I think a lot of the audience already knows, is food marketing to children on TV, and I'm wondering what the implications of this study has, in your view, on those issues.
Well, first of all, I think it would indicate that food marketing to kids on television continues to be an important issue, because there's still a lot of television content that's consumed, and there's a lot of advertising that can be carried in the 4.5 hours of television content a day. But second, I guess, I would say that any policies that we have, whether they are voluntary self-regulatory policies from the food industry or the media industry, or their policies from the FCC or the FTC or Congress, really have to reflect the whole range of types of media that kids are consuming. So if you are consuming 12 and a half hours worth of media content a day, media continues to be primarily an advertising-driven platform, all different types of media for kids. They're getting a lot of advertising messages. And some of those other platforms have a lot more complex ways of interacting with kids and of promoting their products to kids. So we've got to look at interactive advertising. We've got to look at targeted and personalized advertising online. And so I think it just makes the job a lot more complicated and more important than ever.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the audience, I'll ask you to wait for the mic, stand up, identify yourself and your affiliation. It will help those here and also our online audience. Right back here.
Hi, Elaine Kolisch from the Council of Better Business Bureaus. Vicky,
can you hold it a little closer?
Sorry. Vicky, what a fabulous job you did, as usual. Congratulations. A minor question about food advertising. Does your data show what percent of time kids are spending on advert games as opposed to games like Super Mario Brothers?
Okay, quick question and answer. Question back here.
Yes, Gloria Tristani, lawyer and former FCC commissioner. I was struck by the study's findings on the disparity in media usage between whites, African Americans, and Hispanics. And I'd like to hear all your reaction to that, and does it take a look for special tools for African-American and Hispanic parents?
Steve, why don't you start wondering if your audience reflects the findings in Vicky's report?
It
does. Turn your mic on.
Oh, I'm sorry. It absolutely does, and I think, you know, I mentioned with Latino Hispanic youth in particular the co-viewing element. And so the DVRing specifically so they can watch it with their parents or watch it with their family and friends is unique, and it does change our programming philosophy. And so I think we do factor that in when we think about our programming.
Michael?
I think this is a reflection of a lot of things. It's certainly a reflection of neighborhood quality, a reflection of socioeconomic status and opportunities available to them. And when you put that in the context of the outcomes that have been found in the health research of, you know, obesity and anxiety and early sexual activity, et cetera, perhaps we have to, as we debate and are going to start all over again debating the issue of health care disparities, we should think about health risk disparities as well. So if these kids are spending, you know, 50% more time exposed to a medium that we have a body of evidence that shows there are, for some kids, bad outcomes from, we should really be thinking about whether we are being fair in our society by exposing or creating an environment in which there's higher exposure to something that we feel something about is causing poorer health outcomes. And so to really start thinking about this as a health risk disparity as well as a difference in choice.
Vicky?
I guess I don't know why there is this disparity. I think it's something that's really interesting. I would like the foundation to perhaps hold another session where we talk and delve more in depth into issues of race in media and media consumption and explore some of that. My sense from the data are that African-American and Hispanic kids are really enthusiastic early adopters of new technologies and new medias. And I think that that's a large part of what's behind this, is that you see a big difference in cell phone usage and listening to music online on the cell phone and playing the games on the cell phone and the iPod and so forth. So I think that's a part of it.
You know, another interesting finding we haven't talked about yet, and that is the findings related to usage and performance as a student. We can't link it. There is no known cause and effect, and if so, in what direction? But, Don, I'm interested to hear from you what you make of it.
I it seems quite clear to me that it just continually interacts. I think it goes both ways. Mm-hmm. I think what you find out is that the kids who are spending more time studying, therefore less time with the media, get better grades. I also think that the kids who are having more trouble with their grades, totally independent of media, are getting much more satisfaction at going to the media than going to their homework. Mm-hmm. And so it just kind of spirals. There's that trying to separate it is probably fruitless. That it's all causal.
Okay, a question over here.
Yes. I'm Mandeep Dhillon. I'm the CEO of Togetherville, and we build a social platform for families, so a lot of the comments today are really interesting. And I would like to hear your comments on what you expect the role of the computer going forward is for two primary reasons. One, that the parents of the youngest children are actually modeling a different type of behavior because the parents of very young children are the most effective adult Internet users. And the other is that that's actually the only medium where the content is user-generated. If you take a look at television, music, movies, and even gaming, they're produced by other people and the kids are getting access to them. The computer is actually a user-generated broadcast medium. So I'm wondering what you expect 5 years from now you'll find with regard to computer use for young children.
Don, want to take a stab at that?
I can comment a little bit. I'll start if you want to. I mean, I appreciate what you're saying about the potential of the computer to be user-generated content from kids. I think the bulk of it is not user-generated content, and by that I mean the vast, vast, vast bulk of it is not user-generated content, with the exception of comments on Facebook and MySpace. So I think it's interesting that most of what young kids are spending their time on online is content that does come from pretty much the same small handful of media companies that are making the content that they're watching on television.
Yeah, yes. And let me follow up. I think that we're still in the you have a company for computers and you run video games and Michael once worked on movies, and sorry, but we're all old. the platform distinctions are simply going to go away. And in the minds of a lot of these kids, they have gone away. One of the really positive things I think that's come out of this is that go watch a 13-year-old today with a computer. They're incredible producers. I agree with you. Some of it's user. If you go on YouTube, an awful lot of those little clips you're seeing on YouTube, some 14-year-old kid has made in his garage, and they're absolutely beautiful things. You can go online now. You can go and find websites associated with television programs. You must experience this. I saw it with Buffy. I had a couple of grad students working on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where all over the country, young people were writing alternative scripts to Buffy, whole scripts, good stuff. So it has had very positive effects in that way. But one of the things that I think I'm seeing when I watch the kids do this is the distinctions we make between the different media, that's television, that's film, that's radio, aren't there. They don't think about those things. Exactly. It's platform neutral. I think the other thing that we have to think about is that kids are using the same words that we use, but I believe they're defined differently. Friend does not mean what friend used to mean. It is a verb, but also, I'm from a generation, I'm going to friend you. I would get slapped if I'd said that years ago. But also, it is very difficult for me to think of someone I have never met as a friend in the sense of the way I was raised to know friends. But my grandkids have what they consider to be friends in every sense of the word for me that they've never met, except online. So that's changing. The concept of privacy is changing. The concept of social group is changing in ways we don't know yet. And one of the things we have to be very careful about is bringing these old assumptions and presumptions to this new digital world, which is kind of changing the organization.
Steve, and then Michael.
Yeah. I was just going to say, we did a study that said, you know, we asked our audience about their friends. 40% of them they'd never met before. 40% were online friends. And for certain kids, the gay and lesbian community in particular, that is a lifeline for them. Mm-hmm. So they're learning and connecting. That's a positive thing. And they're watching shows together. So I think it is, you're right, it is a absolutely new age in terms of how they're defining the world.
And we really will. It does broaden their world in some positive ways.
And just briefly, I would build on what Don said to call into question and refine your assertion that the computer is the only platform on which media are generated. I think the computer is the platform, and the internet is the area in which is the conduit for new user-generated material. But they're generating material in print, they're generating video material, and they're not originating these on their computers. They're originating them on video cameras and still cameras and all kinds of stuff. So I think that we need to broaden our awareness of the computer as really a portal and the cell phone as a portal, but that the origination is happening all over the place.
Yes, quickly.
And I think what's another really important thing to recognize out of the study is the amount of time that's being spent with the media outside of school versus in school. So if we want to harness the potential in all these creative ways, in this connectivity and communication that kids are doing on their own outside of school, we really should be thinking about how we introduce this technology in schools in positive ways, because there it can be guided. It can be directed to the creative. It can be directed to the educational. And not enough time is being spent thinking about that, harnessing funds for it. I think the FCC chairman talked about the broadband policy initiatives. I think with those policies wiring every school and every home in America, what has to come with that is a public will to harness the powerful media tools in very creative, educational, pro-social ways. And so I think that's a challenge to this community here to think about how that can happen, because then we can shift from the perils to the possibilities and meet the kids where they are and engage them in really positive ways. Rich.
Yeah, and I think that's the key point. I mean, it goes back to what you said earlier on, education, awareness, these types of things, because we can build policy, but and you know, picking on Don, poor Don's been forced to play the role of Karnak today. But, I mean, but you know, who could guess 10 years ago where we'd be today, and who could guess 10 years from now exactly where we'll be? And that's why, you know, if you create a policy at a certain time before you know you're, you know, you've got a great policy for, you know, drive-in theaters and phone booths, but it's not really relevant in the current environment. And so we have to be careful that we're not sitting here, you know, saying we need to do this, when something as simple as early, when technology is introduced, education comes along with it. I mean, when you learn to drive a car, you don't get put on the beltway and they turn on the car and say, now go get them. You know, there's a process where you ease into understanding the ramifications of being behind a steering wheel. In the same way, there should be you know, some wisdom brought with the introduction of technologies into the home and to the school.
Okay. A question up here.
Thank you. Linda Miller, educational consultant with Concerned Children's Advertisers in Canada. I'm sort of piggybacking, Linda, on what you just said. Our concern actually is media literacy. In Canada, it's mandated from first grade on. And we work in multimedia campaigns, actually, to connect health literacy and media literacy. But I really haven't heard the term media literacy being mentioned from the panel at all. As a 38-year educator, I believe that it is the key, that we need to work on that, but not just with children, with parents, with community organizations. And I applaud the study, and I hope that this takes us to a greater place in getting this, as you said, into the schools, homes, and communities of our children. So the words media literacy I'd love to hear at some point. Thank you.
Don Karnak.
Media literacy. I couldn't agree more. And Canada is so far ahead of the United States in this area that it's just pathetic. The United States has totally failed in terms of media literacy. The fact is that you can put all the rating systems out there in the world. You can put PSAs on air. It's going to come down to the consumers. And here we're talking about the kids knowing how to take care of themselves, knowing how to process information, knowing what's going on in those media they're consuming. And we really are not spending many resources in this country on helping them know. The media literacy programs that existed in a lot of schools have gone by the board because we don't want to leave any child behind. And so we'll teach to a test. And so that's just kind of another frill. And yet, as far as I'm concerned, that may be the single most important element in a school curriculum. If you think that education is about teaching kids to process information, then what we should be doing is looking at how we're delivering information and teaching kids about this. And I really think the U.S. has failed in that area.
And yet the kids think that they know it, clearly, right? Yes.
Well, they're very savvy users of media, but they're not necessarily critical users of media. I think that the term media literacy has kind of gotten beaten up in this country a little bit, in part because everybody's got the latest, greatest thing, but nobody has evaluated any of them. And so it's just a bunch of people arguing that their plan is better. And I would say that also media literacy has been sort of cast as something about figuring out what you shouldn't watch. And I think that when we say, look, these kids love media, they're really adept at media, they are true digital natives. We're all immigrants. They're true digital natives. And what we can do is approach literacy the way we approach print literacy. We teach them the good stuff, the fun stuff. We have them read the Shakespeares, and we have them listen to the Mozarts of these new media. And we show them that there is good, bad, and indifferent, and they choose what they want, and that will not only be will not only help their generation and creation of media, but it will also push them to create media on a much higher standard. Now, this makes it harder on producers, but in some ways, because they have to come up with stuff that's really very, very good. But in the other sense, I think our tendency has been to restrict and to censor and limit and to drop portcullises on various media. And instead, what we need to do is empower the kids to want better.
And to evaluate the difference between better and not, you know, as a parent of students, I see them treating all information equal. Mm-hmm. I meant to say before, if there are reporters in the room who may be on deadline, if you can identify yourself and we'll be sure to get to you. You. Yeah, yeah, it's coming your way. Thank you.
Hi. I feel weird standing in the front, so I'm just going to sit back down. my name's Josh Wine. I'm a reporter with Communications Daily. And the panel has sort of hinted about sort of what role policies in the federal government could play, but I just wanted to ask folks to flesh that out a little bit more. And since we had the FCC chairman here earlier, what is the kind of direction that the FCC and Congress should be taking on this? Or is it really a federal issue? Or are we talking about local school districts kind of taking the lead? Or, you know, should the AMA have policies in place for pediatricians about what to say? How do you kind of, you know, orchestrate the right policy, and where does it start?
Linda, do you want to start with that?
Yes. I think there are lots of questions out there, and I think that the chairman did a good job of saying we need to study and recognize that this is a totally new environment before we put forth firm policy proposals. But in the case of Common Sense Media, we've broken it down into three categories. We talk about educating, empowering, and protecting is kind of a frame that we've used for this new digital media world. Education really means what it sounds like. Going out and talking to parents and teachers and kids themselves, creating curriculum to teach kids the basics of digital literacy and citizenship, which to us means bringing some of the care that has been built into certain internet safety kinds of policies and programs with the critical thinking of media literacy, with a whole new sense that behaviorally this is a whole new world for kids and we need to teach them ethics. And so from a policy perspective, looking to funding for both curriculum development, for teacher training, and for the implementation of programs that is a complement to the broadband wiring of schools and homes is critical policy initiative from our perspective. In the empower area, we're talking about technologies and tools, ones that can help direct kids and families to the most educational and positive media that's out there, to thinking about creating more content that is educational. We should be thinking about how to beef that up in a world in which it's not just TV that is a public education element, but gaming, et cetera. And then finally, in the protect arena, that's where we see some of the regulatory issues arising. I think it's very complicated. We used to have something that was all about responsible time, place, and manner in terms of rules to protect kids. With mobile devices and time shifting, you know, that's very hard to define mm-hmm. what you're going to do, but it has to be looked at. Kids need to have some kind of protections in terms of access to content, and I'm not certain how that will shape up. But those are the ways that we're thinking about those three categories. And then finally, I too have a big concern about advertising in this new world. I think that the data that shows that TV is being consumed more than ever but on different platforms, and the fact that advertising can become very, very personal. I can tell you a story. I have a 16-year-old daughter who is on Facebook. She came to me one day and she said, "You know, Mom, what I don't like about Facebook?" And I said, "You don't like something about Facebook?" She said, "What I don't like is that all the ads that are targeted to me are for diet pills. And if I didn't know that it wasn't good for me, I would do something about it." And I kind of laughed and said, "You know, all of the ads that are targeted to me are for anti-wrinkle cream." So, you know, we're in this world in which...
I am not about to tell you. But I am.
But we're in this world where, you know, advertisers can have direct access without a parent in the room and with a lot of data about what kids like and don't like. And so, you know, those rules really need to be looked at as well.
Rich, getting back to the reporter's question, what is the gaming industry's perspective on the policy question?
In part, it goes back to what I said before, is policy at a moment in a fast-evolving kind of time we are, may, depending on how it's directed, may or may not be the right solution. I'm not sure government always has the right answer to these things. I think government can be very helpful in helping to promote and cast light on some of the tools that are available, which is what I spoke about earlier. You know, I think of things like, and you touched on this, where there's a... Where do you embrace these things and the best way possible? You know, just recently at the White House, through the president's STEM initiative, science, technology, engineering, and math, there was an embrace of the value of interactive gaming as a teaching tool and using that as a means to reach a new generation where they are. And we've heard a lot about, you know, how you know, we can try and teach from mm-hmm. Mount Sinai, but they're hanging out in a different place. Also, you know, it's interesting, like the Joan Gans Cooney family, you know, in the 60s, there was this wasteland that was out there called television, and they looked at it and saw as a means to reach young people with educational programming that was entertaining and positive, and that's where Sesame Street came from. Well, just recently, they did a study called Game Changer, and they looked at the current environment where people are looking at video games and gaming as, you know, is it a bad thing, and et cetera. They said, no, this has got amazing opportunity and potential. Let's use it to help educate. And so there's a whole new appreciation approach for that. So, you know, when you talk about policy, I look for more sort of private and public-private mm-hmm. activities to help generate, you know, the best we can with the tools that are available.
Vicki, as Chairman Jenikowski mentioned earlier, you've been working on these issues for so many years, going back to the V-chip. Given the media environment that you've described for our kids today, how difficult is it to begin to think about implementing policy, particularly safeguards, rating systems, technology, when the media world is so diverse?
It's hard, but I mean, I think the first step is to recognize what's the reality of kids' media lives today. So we already have some public policies that are in place with regard to kids and media. We have a policy, the Children's Television Act, that requires broadcasters to provide a certain amount of educational content for kids as part of their public interest obligations. We have limits on the amount of time that can be spent advertising to kids during children's programming on broadcast television. We have media ratings policies in which the media companies have voluntarily adopted ratings. And we have, you know, policies on privacy and so on. But the challenge is that the platforms that kids are consuming the media on have changed so much, and their media habits have changed so much. So how do you have a meaningful policy on educational content for kids, even in the places where we already have policies? We've decided we want to have a public policy on this topic, but the public policy has not kept up to date. So I think the other challenge is, besides the fact that kids' media consumption habits have changed so much, and some of the technology is challenging. Like, if they're watching TV on their cell phone, how does the media ratings system work? But beyond that, there's a jurisdictional challenge in terms of the government agencies. And so, I mean, the FCC does not have – I think kids' media use has transcended the jurisdictional boundaries of the public agencies that regulate and monitor media. And that's a challenge I don't know the answer to.
Michael.
I wanted to respond to the question about the AMA in particular, or the American Academy of Pediatrics, which I'm much more involved with. Since the mid-1980s, the AAP and the AMA have had policies in place, and they have been about as successful as the V-chip. A study done by Kaiser showed that 6% of American parents were even aware of the AAP, of one AAP policy. So the policies are out there. They just aren't getting people's attention. And I think that one thing that struck me about Chairman Jenikowski's comments was I really resonated with his words, where he said he wanted to empower parents, enable kids to ride the digital wave to heights never before seen, and come home safely. And the last time I heard words were that like that were JFK talking about the space race. And the space race was an entire game changer. And this media environment, and I think this study shows that this media environment should be a game changer. So I think we need to step back from our natural instinct, particularly in this town, that policy is legislation and legislation is restrictions or push requirements of what you have to do or what you can't do. And take a step back and say, maybe what we need to do is rethink this whole thing. We need real research. The NIH and CDC have only done a smattering of disconnected funding of research to understand the effects of these media and how we can use them to be better, rather than just using them because they're there and they're fun and they're sexy and we like it. And, you know, outcomes, we'll figure that out when we get there. To take that information to inform parents and empower them with that information and those strategies to make a difference in their kids' lives, and most importantly, to use the parents as a conduit to the kids themselves, so that they are, in fact, media literate, they are, in fact, media critical, and they are using these media in ways that will blow us away when they have the skills and knowledge to do it in an informed and powerful way. So I think that this is the effort that I and my group and many of the other people on this panel are doing, which is trying to get good, solid information and get it in the hands of the people who can really make a difference, which are the parents and the kids themselves.
A question in the back?
Hi, my name is Jana Baldwin. I'm a youth advocate and a recent graduate with my MPH from George Washington University. And I just actually finished my thesis where I looked at what's good with effectively communicating sexual health among the hip-hop generation, which was basically a snapshot among African-American youth in D.C. And interestingly enough, I basically looked at what the youth were seeing as far as sexual health campaigns. And then also I looked at what hip-hop artists the youth were listening to and if they wanted to hear sexual health messages from them, which is also, you know, obviously something which I think is interesting to look at as far as among the African-American youth population, because obviously looking at these statistics with African-American youth that are listening, obviously, to music more and have more media usage, I think that's something that I would be interested in, you know, looking into more, just especially with the hip-hop generation as far as media usage. And I was just curious if that was something that maybe Kaiser, BET, MTV has looked into or would be looking into as far as looking at
hip-hop
artists.
Well, listen, my first day on the job 12 years ago at MTV, I had a wonderful meeting with Vicky Rideout, my literally first meeting. And we, with Kaiser, have been doing sexual campaigns for years. One of the best things with partnering with Kaiser is all the research they do. So we have done dozens of campaigns. The latest we did with Kaiser, the CDC, Planned Parenthood, around STD testing, and for us going, it was called GYT, Get Yourself Tested, and we started virally to get the word out there because we realized it's really hard to reach this audience. We heard from Planned Parenthood and the CDC that year to year, looking at the month of April, 08, 09, the increase in testing was up 25%, which was just, you know, amazing that we could have some small impact. So I know it works. I think I'll toss to Vicky to figure out, were you able to look at specifically the hip-hop community?
Well, first of all, those campaigns, which are run by my colleague here at the foundation, Tina Hoff, and her team, she also has a very strong partnership with BET, and she has partnered with Univision. And we find that media companies are just an excellent partner in joining forces to say, let's use your creative talent as well as your platform and your audience to figure out how we can communicate about health issues with young people. And I found it really interesting that you were, you know, you've been involved in H1N1 and issues like that. And so there's a lot of public health organizations here in the audience who I think will probably be really interested in talking with you about how they can work with you as well. So, yes, we find that it's true that kids who are at risk, and in the public health world, we look at kids who are high sensation-seeking youth, they tend to use more media. So media is an excellent platform for reaching them. I think one of the things that was so great about our partnership when we started it out, Stephen, was that it was kind of a 360 sort of a thing where we were getting kids, you know, on television and online and on your network as well as on BET and on other shows that they watched. And sometimes it was in special programs that you did, full-length shows, and sometimes it was in PSAs. And you've got little bugs on the screen now with GYT, I think. And so it's kind of coming at kids from many different perspectives and many different platforms.
Thanks, Vicky. Yes, a question over here.
Hayden with Common Sense Media. Vicky, question, your data is only looking at media use that's recreational. Did you collect data as to how much media use is school-related, in school, out of school? How does it change things? Because school is using so much more. Be curious.
Yeah, we don't know how much time kids are spending in school using media for schoolwork or for homework outside of school. The only medium where we did ask about that was with computer use. And so if you look in the computer section, there is a question about how much time kids spent using the computer for school and for homework the previous day. And the average was about 16 minutes a day compared to about an hour and a half for non-school use. So that's the only medium where we have those data, though.
Question on this side?
No, he just asked my question.
Okay. Sahar, up here.
Hi, Stephen Balkin with the Family Online Safety Institute. First of all, Don, a statistic from Europe, the average age of kids getting their first cell phone now is down to 8.5 years old. So think about that going forward. Also, Docomo in Japan were demonstrating in Vegas at last year's convention, CTIA's convention, a new waterproof cell phone. The reason was the kids were taking their phones into the bath and the showers with them so that they wouldn't miss a text, because the social conventions now amongst tweens in Japan is that if you leave it for more than 15 to 30 seconds to respond, you're out of the group, in other words. And so they also put it underneath their pillows as well, as someone was mentioning on Vibrate. So I want to go back to the issue about schools, and what advice would you guys give to principals, to educators, to ordinary folks who are trying to run a school about the technology that kids bring to school. Because the way most kids think about it, they're powering down when they go to school. And instead, isn't this something that should be embraced? Or is what the research is saying that because of the media consumption, their grades go down? What advice would you give to educators?
Linda, do you want to start, and then Dawn?
I'll tell you, I think it has something to do with multitasking, though, the answer is. I mean, I have a natural inclination to be nervous about saying, let's find ways that we can get kids to spend more time with media. I understand the desires about taking full advantage of the educational potential of media, as well as the potential to sort of change how kids are taught and how they learn and sort of enhance the creative side of that. But one of the things that we didn't really talk about that much yet is multitasking, and I think that's one of the risks about media use during homework and potentially casual media use in school, not media use that's incorporated into the curriculum, but is the fact that the brain actually can't multitask. The brain can simultaneously switch from one task to another very rapidly, but something is lost in that process. And so that's the area that, of concern that I have about media and homework and media in the classroom.
Linda, Dawn?
It's really a tough question, Stephen. What advice? You know, one of the things that I think I would try is to engage the kids in how are we going to handle this. I think that one of the things that too often happens is that kids go to school and they power down and they also hunker down because the powers that be are going to tell them what to do and how to behave and so forth. And I think we may be missing a bet, because the fact of the matter is they are more skilled with these technologies than we are, and they probably know more ways to get around us than we ever dreamed existed. But if we were to recruit them and say, look, there's some goals we have to reach together, and this is what's going on, how would you help us deal with this? You might come up with some very good ideas. I can tell you that it really has changed. It has been less than 10 years, fewer than 10 years, since I faced my first seminar in which every student walked in the first day and opened his or her laptop. Fewer than 10 years since that happened. And it totally changes the teaching environment, because they are taking notes, but they are multitasking. They are taking notes, and they're tweeting, and they're surfing. And I'll say, oh, 5 years ago somebody did this study. I can't remember who did it, but and within 30 seconds, one of them will say, that was so-and-so, and it's published here. And then they're laughing at the jokes, but they're not my jokes. You know, I tell a joke and I get straight faces, but every so often they're giggling, and you know they're online on something. And it's just a new environment. And schools are struggling with this all the way through the universities. At Stanford now, the law students are not allowed to take laptops. Whereas in other classes, they're encouraged. We're in the middle of the storm, and we don't quite know how to work the umbrella.
The other thing about multitasking is obviously kids are learning skills that you have to be able to multitask in this society to be able to get ahead and really to achieve what you want to achieve. So that's essential. But it seems to me there is also an essential need to be able to think deeply sometimes about something, to concentrate and focus on it. And so I think the question is, if there is just constant stimulation, if that's what you expect and what you need at all times, is constant stimulation and constant multiple sources of stimulation, will we still be cultivating in young people the capacity to stop and think and focus?
Can I follow just one more? I started looking at the amount of time that kids were using with media clear back in the 60s. And trying to figure out how you measure kids' time use, which is very, very difficult. It's because, you know, there's a lot of times we're doing things that we don't think about doing things. And so even if we're the person filling out the time diary, we don't know how to answer the questions. Mm-hmm. But what it got me thinking about was one of the things, if you watch children, or at least if you used to watch children, I don't know if this holds, there are lots of hours of the day when kids seem to shut the system down. they sit and stare at a wall. You know, and you say, oh, well, he's just 13, and yeah, they're just, you know, they're kind of little blobs. I've come to think that that may be some of the most important time in child development, that that's when there's a lot of stuff going on, getting correlated and correlated and put together in those quiet times when we sort of shut the system down and we're not processing incoming stuff but dealing with what's in there. And my big concern, if I have a fear from what we're finding in these studies right now, is that we're eliminating that time. We're creating organisms that are always stimulated. And that has implications that I don't know what they are, but I just have this hunch they're profound.
Yes. I echo your concern, Don. I think that's the biggest concern. Where, where is that other hour and a half that Vicky has counted up this time round? Where is it coming from? There are only 24 hours in a day, and even with all the multitasking, is it coming from, you know, sleeping, studying, or just that basic hanging out and thinking or conversing with friends? And I do think we need more research about this, but we also just need to pause and think about balance in the most commonsensical way that we can. What we say to heads of school is be clear between what kind of technology use is educational versus entertainment and recreational in school hours. On the one hand, the educational piece has great potential, and we should be thinking about how to harness it, because what we do know is that kids are incredibly engaged with media. And we also know that in some ways it's become a bit of an equalizer. I mean, I think actually the access issues to mobile devices could ultimately be very positive in the educational setting. That being said, when kids walk in the door and they're using their cell phones for texting and recreational use, they need to be turned off. They need to be turned off. And there needs to be a time where schools are recognizing if they put technology into the hands of a 10-year-old, they're going to use it for whatever they want to. So think about whether there's an iChat function on that laptop you've provided. We know schools that have not thought consciously about the policies and the lines between education and entertainment and have been caught off guard when they introduce it, and there's a whole lot of backing and filling that needs to be done. That being said, the most successful schools have been the ones that recognized that they had to engage the students in the solution. So I know of one in which, there was iChat going on all during class time because they'd given one-to-one laptop program to kids. They brought the students together and said, how are we going to solve this problem? We can shut it down. We can disenable that technology. The students came back and said, look, what if we only do it during recess or at lunchtime? And they implemented that program, and it's been solved. So I think, we are in a brave new world. We're all going to make mistakes. Schools are going to make mistakes. Parents are going to make mistakes. Kids are going to make mistakes. But if we are, aware, having dialogue, looking at policies and retooling them, I think we're all going to find a way in the future.
Vicky, I just had one quick question. If I recall correctly, kids are reading books a tiny bit more today than 5 years ago. And I'm wondering, given what Don just said, if that is their way to hold on to that kind of timeout period from all of the electronics.
Well, I think it's a really interesting finding. I think part of it has to do with stories and character and the pleasure that one gets from delving deeply into stories and character. I think that's part of the reason that television continues to be more popular than other types of media as well. So I don't know for sure what's going on with it. But
well, We're going to have to cut this off, unfortunately. I think some of the panelists will be able to stay to answer any follow-up questions from some of you in the audience. And I'm going to turn it over for a final word to Vicky.
So I want to thank all of you for coming and, of course, all of our panelists and Chairman Jenikowski. I really appreciate it. I went online this morning to look and see if there was news coverage of the study. And, of course, one of the advantages that online news offers you is that there's comments from people, which I always approach with a great deal of trepidation. And but I was kind of really interested to notice that some of the first comments, and I can't remember if this was in USA Today or I think it was USA Today, was from a girl named Chelsea who was 17 years old, who obviously is consuming online news, which I found was interesting. Then I noticed that she was from Brea, California, and it just dawned on me now that that meant she was up posting her comment at about 3:30 in the morning. So Chelsea, go to sleep. But you know, she talked about using kids using media to pursue their passions. I think that's a really important perspective. A second comment was from somebody named DeWitt, who's a college freshman in North Carolina, who said, I really think all of this new media is just really more ways to get bad news. There was a mom in Chicago named Becky who said one of the things that she does and a tip she was offering to other parents is she said she packs the remotes and brings them with her to work when she leaves. The final one, this was from USA Today site. There was a woman talking about her 15-year-old nephew at their recent family gathering that they had. And she said he spends all of his time sitting on the couch texting and IMing on his cell phone and his laptop. And she wonders what he could possibly be texting and IMing about since he never is doing anything that would be at all interesting to text and IM about except texting and IMing. But then she said something that was really kind of moving. She said in her closing remarks, she said this was a family gathering there. And she said she looked around the room and she realized that this 15-year-old boy was as inactive as his 82-year-old grandmother and had less life experience than her 3-year-old son because all he does is sit on the couch texting. So, again, I think it's just something that is a totally mixed blessing, pursuing your passions or frittering away the time. It's just something that I encourage us to look at from a health perspective. And I guess the final word is I just want to thank everybody at the foundation for supporting this wonderful body of research over the past 10 years. Thank you.